Blog Talk Radio. Well, I hope you were dancing. That was an 8.5-minute workout with the great B.B. King, whose birth strong was this week. I think it was yesterday or the day before, 94, I think. So we're here. This is your community science class, Love Power Show, the Community Love Power Show. I am Yah Elohim. I'm so glad to be here. Got a good workout just now. Brought my energy up even higher, and I look forward to what we're going to be sharing today. So this is the 12th episode, of which two were duds. So this is actually maybe about the 10th episode that we've been doing. And what we're going to be talking about today is a completely new topic, which is, sorry for that noise there, which is the sustainability movement and the eco movement. And this is a really fascinating topic for me because I'm highly involved in sustainability. I have so much sustainability built into what I do in my business, in my marketing, and in my business plan. So it just caught my eye when I was looking at the 5G summit. I was trying to find the presenter who was talking about sustainability as a population control device, which I had heard that before. It's not the first time, but I hadn't actually paid much attention to it or given it much credence. But, and as I move through life, I have learned that the still small voice, or the one that sounds on the fringe, is often the one who's done the work to come forth with at least some information that will allow me to make a more informed decision. So that's the purpose of today's program, today's sharing. So we know about the goal for sustainability, many of us, Agenda 21 and Agenda 2030, and they are well underway. So as I just said, sustainability is, I do so much around sustainability every day, like recycling and growing our food and buying and eating organic. And so I never really saw it as an elitist thing, but I do realize that people around the world just live that way. They just recycle everything. Recycle a piece of thread, a rubber band. Everything has multiple use. It's not something that's like a trend. So I started looking at that aspect of it and the behavior control and how it's now become very trendy to be sustainable. If you look at the arguments for sustainability, however, for certain aspects of it, especially with pollution, the chemicalization of the environment, those to me are very important. Intertwined and mixed in is population control. We're going to look at that and what does that mean and what is that really an agenda for. And so that's where we're going today. As always, before we do that, we have our hot topic. And our hot topic is about cymatics. The hot topic is not necessarily directly related to the program, that the topic of the program, but it is still something important, fascinating, uplifting, and transformative. So let's look at cymatics for a few minutes. You know what cymatics is?
The Great Pyramid of Giza. Built into this incredible structure is what's known as the King's Chamber. Close to the west wall of the chamber is a red Aswan granite coffer. The walls of this coffer are about 6 inches thick. On the outside, it measures about 7.5 feet by 3.5 feet. On the inside, 6.5 feet by 2.5 feet. So you can see why someone would think that this was designed to be a sarcophagus for the king. On the southeast corner of the coffer, you can see that a large section of the corner has been damaged or broken off. Now, there are stories that suggest that the coffer was struck by something very hard to create this damage, which is interesting because when this hard granite coffer is hit with something hard, it vibrates, just like a bell. In 1997, acoustic physics researcher John Stuart Reed was granted permission to conduct a series of experiments within the king's chamber. And what he did was he temporarily repaired the damaged corner of the coffer, and he did this so that he could then stretch a large elastic membrane across the opening, like a drum. Before he did this, however, he placed a sound device or speaker inside the coffer before covering the opening with the membrane. He then poured sand across the surface of the membrane and began to conduct sound tests, and what he discovered was mind-blowing. The granules of sand begin to form patterns, shapes, and these shapes were very similar to that of Egyptian hieroglyphs. One of the other interesting things that occurred during these experiments is that John had been suffering from chronic back pain, which was somehow magically healed, and he claims that pain never returned. I'm going to discuss something that should help us come to a greater understanding of life and how everything works. Another puzzle piece to help some of the other pieces make sense and connect. And that is the science of making sound visible. Cymatics. There is a pattern that exists, and this pattern seems to be infinite. This pattern is found in nature, it is found in us, it is found in the stars. In 1202, a mathematician known as Leonardo Fibonacci introduced the Hindu-Arabic numeral system to the Western world through a book known as the Book of Calculation, or Book of Abacus. Within this book, there is a description of a number sequence that was written about in India. But since it was popularized by this book, it later came to be known as the Fibonacci sequence of numbers. Each number in the sequence is the sum of the two numbers that came before it. 0 plus 1 equals 1. 1 plus 1 equals 2. 1 plus 2 equals 3. 2 plus 3 equals 5. And so on and so forth. Now, if you take these numbers and create squares with lengths of their sides equal to the numbers in the sequence, you can tile them to give you what's known as the Fibonacci spiral or pattern. The same pattern found in seashells, artichokes, pineapples, pine cones, trees, leaves, flowers. It is found in the DNA's double helix, your arms, hands, and fingers. Your face. These are the fundamentals to the science of sacred geometry, something that is not new. I've discussed Dr. Masaru Emoto's rice experiment, his water crystallization experiment. I know some of you have tried this and have seen the results. Do you all understand that when you do this experiment, you are literally destroying something with your mind? So would it make sense that if you can destroy something with your mind, you could also fix it or even create it? Do you see the Fibonacci pattern in the beautiful water crystallization when it is loved? So what's happening here? How is the energy that comes out and off of our bodies affecting other matter? We all know its frequencies. In fact, it's more than that. Resonant frequencies. sound. With the science of cymatics, we can now see what these sounds look like. This is a cymoscope. It is an instrument that can be used to create a visual image of sound vibration. This is basically a petri dish that is on a plate that has been insulated from the natural vibration of whatever the cymoscope is resting on. You can then use very fine particulates or ultra pure water to reveal the structures of the harmonics that pass through the cymoscope. At low frequency sounds, you get very simple geometric patterns. The more you raise the frequency, the more complex these patterns become. This is one of the 3D structures that is created in water using sound. This is an actual image of water, with the surrounding body of water removed for contrast. The most abundant crystal on the earth is quartz, a mineral composed of silicon and oxygen. Like most inorganic solids such as metal, rock, and ice, it is a polycrystal, a mass of microscopic crystals that were fused together to form one large solid mass. Now here's the question. If the patterns or structures that are within a crystal like quartz are actually the imprint of resonant frequencies or sound, does this mean that the energy of that frequency is also captured within the crystal? Do you understand now why people use crystals in rituals and in healing? Because just like you give off vibrations, objects, crystals give off vibrations as well. And all these vibrations affect each other. Listen carefully, folks. I just showed you how sound affects the atomic structure of water. And we can see how sound may have an effect in the way minerals like quartz crystallize. So how do you think sound affects your body, which is mostly quartz and water? We know that there are patents of sonic weaponry that can do a lot of cellular damage to a large number of people all at once. But at the same time, we have technologies that use sound to heal. This is cymotherapy, acoustic therapy, harmonic therapy. This is the science behind chanting, humming, or aumming, and Sanskrit. It is the science behind using crystals, a Tibetan bowl, or classical music by people such as Bach or Beethoven. This is the science behind relaxation audios and binaural beats. Using sound therapy, researchers have been able to repair torn living tissue and repair it to the point where it appears as if the tissue was never damaged at all. They have been able to improve circulation in parts of the body and remove blockages, particularly in the legs and arms. It has been used to repair organs and improve brain function. You see, sounds affect your body. Music affects you. Words affect you. When you write a word, that word has energy just like everything else, and when someone else reads that word, it affects them on a cellular level. When we hear or see a negative word, we feel it. When we see or hear a positive word, we feel it. When you hear or see something funny, you laugh, which is a double bonus because even the sound of laughter can raise your body's frequency. This is what raising your body frequency means. You are raising the resonant frequencies in your body to be more in line with the complex crystalline structures that promote good health and longevity. Have you ever listened to a song that you like, or have ever watched a movie or video that touched you? And at a certain point, that audio or video stimulated a sensation that is often felt on the skin across the scalp and back. A tingling sensation. Similar to what happens when someone runs their fingertips gently down your back. Have you ever wondered what that feeling is? This is called autonomous sensory meridian response, or ASMR. You may have seen videos where people are whispering and performing mundane tasks like turning the pages of a book or making subtle clicking and tapping sounds. They do this to trigger this response. And it works, especially for people who are very sensitive to the ASMR. Watching someone do this for about an hour can sometimes be a bit overwhelming if you are sensitive to it. However, it is very therapeutic, and the effects this has on stress is incredible. Want to have a relaxing night after a hard day's work? Get into a nice hot Epsom salt bath for about 40 minutes with your eyes closed, just listening to someone perform these ASMR triggers. When you get out of that bath, you will feel like you have never felt before. See, the Epsom salt detoxes the cells for the first 20 minutes and then supplements your cells with magnesium for the last 20 minutes.
Relaxing. Wow, really great information. That is what you need to know about cymatics and ASMR. The whole way that he explained the resonance of the universe and how we're all connected and the resonance of our frequency of the quartz, I feel was a very, very lucid explanation. I hope you feel so too. That's actually just our hot topic. And that's cymatics and how to use it for healing, sound therapy is essentially what he's talking about in the various modality. So as I said, today's topic is very fascinating. I've heard of the agendas 21 and 2030, and that they are possible tools for I said all this for depopulation already. I know they came out of the UN. And the UN came out of policies put forth by the League of Nations, and that at the time, at this time, just as the agenda stated, that it should affect everyone on the globe, it pretty much is affecting everyone on the globe. No matter where you go, you hear about sustainability, you hear about climate change. Radio running in the background, I've heard the words climate change about 10 times in the past 4 hours. So without critical thinking, I would, especially being of the boomers, I would assume that the whole sustainability and climate change movement arose from the work of people like Rachel Carson and the work that she had done. So book, Silent Spring, of course, you know, in my mind, that marked the beginning of the environmental movement in the West, the way in the form that it has now as a kind of elitist movement, but necessary. It started with this 1972 conference in Stockholm. So this whole sustainable development concept by others, Barbara Ward, Rachel Carson, I'm on Amazon looking at this information. These are the founders, in my mind, of the environmental movement. So that's what I've always thought. I don't know if that's incorrect thinking or not, but that's what I always thought. People like Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring, who was one of the people at the forefront of the conversation about the environment, DDT, all of that. That's where I thought that the sustainable movement, the recycling, and all arose out of that. I guess I'm going to find out. So then I have definitely heard it said that sustainable development is a concept that is embracing genocide because it's talking about population control. And I have to say that in the darker, poorer nations where you're talking about population control, where you have the lighter, richer nations, in a real birth decline, I always have to posit, is this not an issue of survival? You know, we hear about the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, how sustainability started, as we said with Rachel Carson and Barbara Ward. Excuse me. And develop from there, excuse me. Had to sneeze. And so we talk about this collectivist and sustainability movement that has developed with various policies that have arisen around the globe. So what has happened now is that there's a pushback on sustainability, talking about the fact that from a couple of directions, probably more than two. For one thing, saying that it's a population control agenda of the West towards the rest of the world, of the developing world, because of very real declining population numbers of the West. And that also the resources in the places where you have large populations, the minerals and other resources that are necessary for the continuation of the high-tech industrialized Western society. But you really have to say that even before the Club of Rome, these concepts have started to arise. This is over 50, 60 years ago. Limits on growth and the new path for world development. These are have as their goal the movement to globalize the planet, one world government, as we see moving forward, that agenda moving forward. Social engineering everything, and we see that everything is socially engineered, the behavior, especially with the digitalization and the cell phone, and all the dangers of the cell phone, no matter how wonderful they are and how much we all rely on them. So now we have a pushback movement, and that movement is to deindustrialize the planet. And so I'm not sure where I fit in. This is new for me to actually see where I fit, because essentially I do agree with deindustrializing the planet. Don't agree with population control. I agree with more equitable division of the resources that exist on the planet, and that for the places where they go and take resources from poor people of countries of higher and denser population, pay the people a fair price for the resource you're taking, and people become self-sufficient. So where this whole environmentalism come from? So there is a myth, or there's information out there, that's why I put it in the title, that there is a, and this is, it's not a myth that there's a false environmentalism. To me, it's a myth, in my humble opinion, it's a myth that green movement arose out of the Nazi party, because there were people all over the planet that were not Caucasian, that had been living green from conception, from the rising of their culture. So if you want to say that for Caucasians or for the Western world, the green movement arose out of the green movement of the Nazi party, I cannot dispute that. But that doesn't really have anything to do with me or the way that I practice or the way that my people who are indigenous traditional people who live on the land have lived and still live. So that perspective to me is kind of Eurocentric, but I can't comment. So let's look a little bit at that perspective, though. Let's look at the perspective of the Nazi influence on the Green Party. the whole green movement.
I'm your host, Ben Weingarten, a conservative writer and the founder and CEO of Change Up Media. And today I'm joined by Rupert Dharwal. He's written extensively for a number of publications. And today we're discussing his latest book, Green Tyranny, Exposing the Totalitarian Roots of the Climate Industrial Complex. Rupert, in Green Tyranny, you write, and I'll quote here, "Virtually all the themes of the modern environmental movement are prefigured," unquote, "in the Nazis' support of wind power in the 1930s. Explain this.
Yeah, if you look at what the Nazis were doing in the 1930s and their environmental policies, virtually every theme you see in the modern environmental movement, the Nazis were doing. So it happens to be a historical fact that the Nazis were the first political party in the world to have a wind power program. It also happens to be a fact that they were against meat eating, and they considered that it was terribly wasteful that so much grain went to feed livestock rather than to make bread. It's also the case that they had the equivalent of fuel economy rules because they had the most expensive gasoline in Europe, and so they basically had very few people driving cars. So virtually everything that you see, I think actually the most extraordinary thing that I came across was this quote from Adolf Hitler, where he told an aide once, "I'm not interested in politics, I'm interested in changing people's lifestyles." Well, that's extraordinarily contemporary. That is what the modern environmental movement is all about. It's about changing people's lifestyles.
And the subtitle of your book is Exposing the Totalitarian Roots of the Climate Industrial Complex. So you have Nazi practices that are focused on environmentalism, and you explore how the...
So, I don't know how to quite take that. His name is Rupert Dunwaller, and it's a long 30-minute almost piece of information. It almost sounds in his tone, and I could be mistaking it, that he is bigging up the Nazi Party for the beginning of the Green Movement. He's also downplaying the importance of the Green Movement. I'm not sure how to take that, but again, I am just starting to look at this information, and I know traditionally, way before 50 or 100 or 150 years ago, people traditionally for millennia lived and recycled everything. So I'm feeling, as my eyes are opening about the sustainability movement, that it is somewhat of a social engineering piece. It is based on things that are valid in terms of the biodynamic aspects of how we live, but how everyone has lived except the Western people. So it is a behavior control mechanism. The more I look at it, my opinion is forming as I speak. This is not what I came to conclude before I started this. I am looking at this, and I'm saying, really? You know, they're talking about being vegetarian or vegan, which I do know I don't know, but it's purported or rumored that Adolf Hitler was a vegetarian, and I don't know I never studied the Nazis, so I don't know enough to speak knowledgeably about what they ate or what they didn't eat or what their agenda is. I'm just looking at this information. It is fascinating to me. I'm going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and look at climate change, and where does climate change fit into that, and where does climate change fit into sustainability and so many different aspects of what it is that we're doing. It's causing me to examine my whole lifestyle and the value systems that I say I put forth, because I love growing our food. I love eating organic. I'm just looking to see if it's a social engineering experiment, and if it is, what does that mean for me? Do I continue to do it? It's working for me. I feel it's working for me. So let's take a short break.
Something pounding in my breast when I lay down to take my rest. Oh, what a feeling that am. Horrid nightmares, scary dreams, and the blue steps on the scene. Oh, what a wreck I am. Oh, maybe it's the blues that keeps me worried all the time. If I could lose these weary blues that's on my mind. Happiness that comes around but never comes to stay. If I only had someone just to dry my tears away. Now maybe it's love that makes me head around and cry. I'll keep your picture hanging around. Lord, I want somebody just to hold my hand. I'm breaking down. Maybe it's the blues that's on my mind.
Thomas A. Dorsey, Maybe It's the Blues. So that's our break. And what we are looking at is the population control agenda. Let's look at that for a minute. This is from Human Life International. These are some pro-life people. And what they're saying is, this is by Brian Clowes, C-L-O-W-E-S, Ph.D., he says that the United Nations Security Council is the highest decision-making body on foreign policy in the U.S. On 12/10/1974, it promulgated a top-secret document entitled National Security Study Memorandum, or NSSM 200, also known as the Kissinger Report. Its subject was the implications of worldwide population growth for U.S. securities and overseas interests. This document, published shortly after the first major international population conference in Bucharest, was the result of the collaboration of the CIA, USAID, Departments of State, and Agriculture and Defense. So what is basically saying that population growth around the planet is poorer, darker people multiplied, that's a security risk for the U.S. It is critically important because it exposes the unsavory and unethical motivations and methods of population control. The purpose of the Kissinger Report is to maintain access to the mineral resources of less developed nations or countries. It says that the U.S. economy will require large and increasing amounts of minerals from abroad, especially from less developed countries. That fact gives the U.S. enhanced interest in the political, economic, and social stability of the supplying countries. Wherever a lessening of population pressures through reduced birth rates can increase prospects for such stability, population policy becomes relevant to source supplies and to the economic interests of the United States. In order to protect U.S. commercial interests, NSSM 200 cited a number of factors that could interrupt the smooth flow of materials from lesser developed countries to the U.S., including a large population of anti-imperialist youth whose numbers must be limited by government population control. The document identified 13 countries that would be the primary target of U.S. government population controls in 1974. So, on and on. Look for the Kissinger Report. Or you can go to Human Life International, Exposing the Population Control Agenda, and read the entire Kissinger Report. Read the entire Agenda 21. I actually got the Agenda 21 and started reading it, and I don't know, I didn't finish. So we're going to take another little quick break, and then we're going to come return and talk about climate change. Getting through. I'm so grateful. It is such a journey.
like I'm trying to be funny, but I'm really serious this time, baby. Even though it's a cold world, baby, but you know deep down inside that I do love you.
Well, that is the unique Bootsy Collins. Everyone who knows Pop Funk knows Bootsy Collins, following African American soul music. So, I wanted to make sure that we define ecofascism before we move on to talk about climate change. So, I went straight to Wikipedia, and what they have to share is that ecofascism is a theoretical political model in which an authoritarian government would require individuals to sacrifice their own interests to the organic whole of nature. So, their own interests, okay. Because, the term is also used as a rhetorical pejorative to undermine the environmental movement, and in the UK, it has been used to describe far-right efforts to gain influence from the Green Party of England and Wales. Some writers have used it to refer to the hypothetical danger of future dystopian governments, which might resort to extreme or fascist policies to deal with environmental issues. So that is Wikipedia's definition of ecofascism. So what does that mean? It means that a society which you are forced to follow green measures as that's because in a fascist environment. So there is a lot of info on the on the web of conservative people equating the green movement with ecofascism and with a future dystopian world where they would have to give up their resources. It really, from my perspective, boils down to they would have to give up their resources. They're living a certain way and they really don't want to live another way, the way that the majority of the planet has been living. That's why it becomes a social control experiment or behavior experiment for Western people to live in harmony with nature. The whole society is anti and harmony with nature. We spent weeks talking about 5G, and that is, and you know, and all the G's before, all the generations of wireless technology, that alone takes us out of the realm, and the whole world wants that. So, climate change. What is climate change? Climate change is when any long-term significant change happens in the expected average weather pattern. That's so general to me. There seems, because to me there would be rhythms. The Earth is not always going to be doing the same thing at the same time. I do realize that there are rhythms in the climate. I do observe that human interference or action on the planet has accelerated the time in which we expected to live in this pattern. It does not necessarily mean that it's it's just something, an aberrant thing. It could also be part of a rhythm. It's got to be part of a rhythm, what the Earth is doing. The climate has shifted in a generation. The little ice age we're about to talk about happened in a generation, meaning when my son was born, it was temperate, and by the time he reached the age he is now, it's an ice age. Okay? So let's look at birth control as a climate change prevention strategy, because this is what the West is putting forth as the solution. is they're calling it the solution no one wants to talk about. Voluntary birth control is a climate change solution nobody wants to talk about. A growing population means greater environmental strain. The solution could be rooted in women's rights. And this is what the anti population control people are saying, including me. They're projecting it as women's rights, and they're putting it up on an agenda that you can almost not deny. How could you not deny women the right to grow their own food, to have destiny of their own life? They're populating the areas of the world that have the resources. This is an article out of HuffPost. Voluntary birth control is a climate change solution nobody has to talk about. In Ethiopia, environmental activism might appear a little uncustomary to some. Health workers can be seen going door to door delivering pamphlets about restoring the country's forests, and they might be handing out condoms while they're at it. The effort is part of Population Health Environment, Ethiopia Consortium's initiative to show residents the intractable link between overpopulation and its toll on the environment. The nation has experienced population growth and land depletion caused by drought, but is now focused on reforestation efforts, which also include family planning. On and on. Okay? So there you have it. So there is the agenda. I am working this out as I'm speaking. I did not come to this program with a predefined opinion, forming one, because now they're talking about condoms with reforestation in a developing nation that has resources that would be of interest to the Western economy. The genocide of indigenous people heralds the Little Ice Age. So we already have seen how genocide affects the climate. Oh, hold on. I need to get that from somewhere else. Technical glitch. Okay. Here we go.
Scientists may finally have an answer to what caused the Little Ice Age of the 17th century. A new study claims that roughly 50% of a global cooling effect during that era was caused by the loss of 90% of 60 million indigenous lives during European colonization of the Americas.
Most sources point towards the number of 6 million people, like indigenous people, living in the Americas. So from 60.5 to 6 million people, that's how we then see arrived at the 90% depopulation.
According to the study, Christopher Columbus kicked off European colonization when he landed in 1492. 55 million indigenous people across the Americas died over the next century through events like genocide and disease. That removed millions of carbon producers from the equation and left an estimated 56 million hectares of land vacant.
This population practiced a substantial amount of agriculture that obviously then had an impact on land management. So there was not enough workforce available to actually manage these fields anymore, which means forest returns or natural vegetation returns.
Nature then reclaimed that land, and the massive jump in plant life and photosynthesis absorbed 7.4 petagrams, or 7 billion metric tons, of carbon from the atmosphere and converted that to oxygen and sugar. Those factors resulted in a cooling of the atmosphere. Winters in the Little Ice Age averaged 2 degrees colder than the modern era.
We can't really even talk about apologies or moving forward until we see that full accountability, and boy, someone's got to account for this.
Dr. Pamela Pometer is a well-known activist and faculty member at Toronto's Ryerson University. She told Global News that population figures supported by science have a high value, and Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission should take note.
This report substantiates what, you know, the chair of the TRC said, that it wasn't just cultural genocide that Canada committed here. It was also physical and biological. This kind of, you know, scientific hard data shows just how extensive the genocide was, and that means something different for Truth and Reconciliation. there's never been a real accountability for what happened. We just say, you know, we had these good policies and oops, they went wrong. Instead of actually saying, this many people died. This is what we did. These are the people that we sterilized. These are the people that we scalped. These are the people that we murdered. And here's the impact to the earth, to the people, and to us. What does it mean for us as a society?
Good questions. And what it shows is that the depopulation of a planet or of a part of the planet has a profound impact on climate. And so we know that the agenda for depopulation of the parts of the planet that are highly populated with, densely populated with pieces of people of color will have an impact on the climate. What's it going to do to the climate? Is it going to make it more tropical? Is it going to make it more temperate? What happens when millions of people are removed? We know, we have posited that AIDS and HIV have been put as a major depopulation effort in Africa. We did numerous programs over that about that over the past 10 or 15 years. So we will not be laboring now. For us, it's pretty much a fact. And we have behind-the-scenes firsthand information about why that is a fact. So now, as they're moving forward to depopulate Africa, they are blatantly talking about depopulating Africa. And Bill Gates no longer even has to pretend or presume to have actual interest in anything other than resources.
The population of Africa is set to almost double by 2050, raising fears that progress in fighting poverty and disease will be reversed. So, what can be done to ensure that poverty doesn't increase? And how can a disproportionately large youth population help drive progress? With me to discuss all of this and more is Bill Gates. Bill, are we at a turning point where regression is a real risk?
Well, first, the progress over the last several decades has been pretty amazing, both reducing childhood death, getting kids in school, getting agricultural productivity up, and reducing extreme poverty. But it's really Africa that still has a doubling in population to 2050 and probably another doubling to 2100, where you really have to do a good job if you're trying to get these extreme poverty rates down. So if we don't do better in investing in human capital in Africa, yes, the number of people in extreme poverty is actually going to go up.
Should the solution, or should more solutions be focused on slowing that growth? So, for example, increasing reproductive rights for women or spreading the access to contraceptives, because it seems that, is it correct that no amount of investment can really keep pace with that population growth?
What we do between now and 2050 with education, with economic growth, with health and nutrition, that'll really set the course for moderating the population growth between 2050 and 2100. But it's really a virtuous cycle. Letting women have reproductive health tools that they want, you know, educating girls, raising agricultural productivity, getting these malnutrition interventions on a much greater scale than we have today. Those are the things you would want to do anyway. It turns out that by doing those well, you also set the population growth rate coming down quite a bit. And so it just makes it that much more imperative that we invest in the human capital now, and so that the challenge of what under any scenario will be fairly high population growth, that you're able to benefit from all those young people making a big contribution to their country.
So is the fact that Africa has such a high proportion of youth population and within the context of this predicted growth, is that something that you think is a sort of optimistic statistic? I mean, is it a good thing that there's an opportunity here to sort of harness the power of those young people?
It's both an opportunity and a challenge, because the capacity to run the health systems well, to get the education system to have not only high attendance but good learning outcomes as well, That's not going to be easy. If we don't make these investments, that youth bulge, will be a huge challenge because they won't have the development, they won't have the economic opportunity that they deserve. So it's potentially an asset, but if we don't invest right, it could even be a liability.
Let's talk about digital technology for a minute. We know that more people than ever before are connected, more people than ever before have bank accounts. Those are both positive, but what would you say are the biggest opportunities in digital technology in terms of fighting poverty and disease?
Yeah, digital innovation is really pervasive. And so whether it's tracking, do you have the vaccines out where they should be, getting feedback from citizens, is the teacher showing up and doing a good job? Digital systems let you achieve a higher quality and really assure, whether it's the domestic taxpayers or the donors, that their money's going to the right things in a way that without digital we couldn't do.
I just want to turn back to the U.S. for a minute. Under the current U.S. administration, under President Donald Trump, there's been a lot of threats to cutting the foreign aid budget and even withholding funding from U.N. agencies. Is it damaging that kind of rhetoric that exists right now?
Well, certainly.
So that's Bill Gates talking about the necessity to reduce the population in Africa in order to give the people that live there a higher standard of living, more education, and more access to digital. So anything that reduces population there is going to also free up more resources for the people locally and much more resources for global access. So we're at the point where we're going to stop because we want to look next program about agenda, seriously more about agenda 21 and agenda 2030. We'll go into more depth. So to answer the questions that were posed at the beginning, did the Green Movement originate with the Nazi Party? I cannot say that it originated with the Nazi Party. I can say that early in the European movement, in European history, the Nazi Party adopted some of the principles of the Green Movement, even down to the actual words that they used to describe some of their really manifestos. So the answer is, I don't believe it originated, but I do believe that they adopted many of the values, which is doing less harm and, on the planet, a smaller footprint, using wind power, not eating animals because of the amount of resources that they use. There's so many people around the planet that took up that same way of living based on observation, just the way that they hijacked swastika, turned it in a different way in terms of the pointing of the arms on the swastika, which is the Indian symbol, and a lot of those principles are Indian. The vegetarian is an Indian principle, and using the technologies that are consistent with nature is throughout the entire so-called undeveloped world. The world of people of color use ingenuity to be able to work with nature. For millennia, I would more posit that they hijacked a part of someone else's philosophy or way of living that they saw and then interjected their other beliefs to make a particular belief system. I cannot support the fact that it originated with them because it predated them. So that's that, and we identified ecofascism. We will take up next program with the agendas, more about the population control, perhaps, just the parts that we didn't get to. And we can talk about really what is really the long-term effect of Agenda 21 and Agenda 2030. So don't forget our farm tour is coming up on Saturday, October 5th. Contact us. UrSustainableCommunities@gmail.com. The letter U, the letter R, sustainablecommunities@gmail.com. You can go to Eventbrite and put in farm tours, farm walks, and farmer talks. Farm walks and farmer talks, PHARMER, farmer, and you can register there as well. Thank you. We're going to end with just instrumental Hazel Scott. Whatever happened to Hazel Scott? Around midnight. Thank you for joining. See you soon. It was awesome. I can't wait to move forward. We have some other really great topics. If we had finished the Agenda 21 and Agenda 2030 before the end of the hour, we will launch into some other really great topics. We want to talk about that magnificent reishi for your immune system and for reversing serious pathologies. We want to look at cosmic beneficence, how to tap into the energy frequency that is there to support the growth, transformation, and expansion. So these are upcoming topics. Please join us. You can always dial us or go to our show page, blogtalkradio.com/URSustainableCommunities, the letter U, the letter R, Sustainable Communities, one word. Love you to life. Hazel Scott, Round Midnight.